Hello there, I'm Tim and here's John and this is How to Murder Time, a podcast about games and things.
Hello everybody.
Whatcha?
We look something a bit different. Well, something a bit old.
Yeah, yeah.
Literally a bit old.
I never really knew how this was going to work for video, but fortunately that's not my problem. So
yeah, it's, my
it's a topic show and I'm just going to talk lots.
There may be sarcastic captions.
I expect so. I understand you take the opportunity to do that whenever you can,
yeah.
Knowing that I don't really watch the thing. Yes, this. So you join us in mid nerdgasm here because I'm at the studio, the illustrious How to Murder Time Studios, and the co-host here has managed to dig out a precious relic, an artifact from the past, which
from
is
a bygone age,
a more civilized age. It's called a ZX Spectrum Plus 2. It's the grey one with the tape deck on the side. 128K.
That's what you had, wasn't it?
This was my first computer, not this very one. Obviously, I don't know where mine went. It broke. I think you know the membrane
yeah,
where the keyboard connects
yeah.
to the main motherboard, that all got brittle and cracked, and my dad tried to fix it with a soldering iron.
And that did not work, did it?
No, not really.
Do you know there's
no.
a company that specifically makes those?
Yeah, so that was the end of my first computer, but that's all right. It was onwards and upwards from then. I didn't look back. It was onto an Amiga, and after that, my first PC, and the rest is history. But just looking at this artifact in front of me, look, you can hear that. Practically, we were just commenting on how unusable the keyboard actually is in modern terms compared to a normal.
Yeah, you look at the Spectrum Plus 2 and it looks like it's a good keyboard,
but it
isn't.
It's certainly an improvement on the rubber-keyed 48K Spectrum of iconic design.
Or the Spectrum Plus.
Look, he's got a plus there as well. This is like a computer museum, this. It's fantastic. But this is extremely relevant, this. I'm holding in my hands basically what it was my first computer, which is my entrance into the gaming world, which has defined me and made me so much of what I am today. And the Plus 2 I had was, I don't know, I must have been about 11, 12, 13, something like that.
Yeah,
we're talking
that,
1980,
yeah.
blah, 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 blah. 1985, six, yeah, something like that.
6, 7, 8.
I'm 41
was, yeah.
now, so you do the math because I can't be bothered. But I must have been at this for about 30 years. More or less.
Yeah.
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 And that's a very long time to spend doing anything, really. And you can't do something as devotedly and as, I don't know about passionately, perhaps that's not right, quite the right word, certainly dedicatedly, as long as I have, as long as you have, without it changing you in some regards. And anyway, so I'm sat here holding this and I'm having just a massive nostalgia attack. And that's essentially what this topic show is about. I've been listening to the various, partly is all this, and partly I think I was listening to 3MMO, the Tebow and Jen there, and they had Petter on and they were having a bit old chat. They went completely off mission. And sort of, you know, ran out of news
really?
About halfway in.
I wouldn't be surprised.
But what followed was a fascinating sort of just general chit-chat about gaming and about, you know, about the olden days, and Star Wars Galaxies came up, as it often does. And, you know, it was a very nostalgic thing, quite heartwarming, and, you know, it was a good episode. I recommend going and listen to it. But it got me thinking, and I was just thinking about nostalgia and how that really informs and dictates and drives my gaming and my desires as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I mean, regular listeners and viewers will know that I'm quite a fan of the old games, the abandonware, the old classics. I have a shelf, my fantastic new IKEA bookshelf that I built myself. And the reason I've got that is because largely I've got far too many books and I need to keep them somewhere, obviously. But also I have CDs dating back to the turn of the millennium and beyond for PC games from the 90s that I still keep and sometimes still try and start and use. I say try because, you know, modern DRM tends to screw with that any chance it gets. And it gets more and more difficult to actually keep running these things. But I believe you buy a game and you play it for life. And so many of my formative experiences, my really oldest memories, you know, are happy times playing computer games of a very old vintage. And that is something that I can't let go. And perhaps it hampers me with my desire to look for new things. People are always, you in particular, yeah. always sort of yeah,
well,
telling me I should go and
that,
play this new thing and play that new thing.
I've just handed you a bit of hardware.
Oh, it's another little box. It's got a Raspberry on it.
Yes,
what's
this,
that?
This is a Raspberry Pi.
It's a Raspberry Pi. It's
a Raspberry Pi 3.
It's about the size of a credit card, but about a centimetre or two deep.
That's mainly because of the connector.
The circuit
inside.
Board inside is literally the size of a credit card, yeah.
This is a little computer that runs emulators. It runs a copy of Linux
emulators.
And lots of emulators.
Emulators are another
And it emulates
huge thing
everything
for me,
yeah. up to I think it's the Dreamcast.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything up to the Dreamcast.
I was doing some research for this show and prep for the show and some video and stuff, and I came across archive.org.
Yeah.
And they have a section, they have basically a what amounts to an online museum of 8-bit computer games. They've got this very Spectrum here that you can play in a browser window.
We live
in the science fiction future, we really do. But in there, I found Elite, the original Elite, and I'll come on to that in a minute. But And I gave it a go. It was there, it was running. And I thought, well, that's a lot easier than trying to find a Spectrum and a cassette tape and get it to run for 2 minutes and load and everything. So these things are preserved and there is a demand there. So let's have a look at the... I made my notes as usual here. Look at that paper. Proper scrawling.
I'd just like to point out, because you guys can't see it.
It's almost a running order.
His notes have a patch on them where he stuck a post-it note over a section.
There's a post-it note on... It's not a patch. There's nothing under it. That's more of a sort of an adamendum.
There is stuff under it.
Yes, I know. I must remember to look under that one. So yeah, okay. So let's have a look at nostalgia then. So I've written that. So retro gaming, nostalgia, remakes, replays and changes. The sort of overall themes there. It's the nostalgia in particular that I'm interested in because it's what happens to me so much. And I imagine many of our listeners are of a somewhat older gaming persuasion. I don't imagine we've got many under 20s listeners.
I'm sure we got some. And they're very welcome.
Absolutely.
But I think we do appeal to the older gamers.
I certainly know we have quite a few older gamers who've been at this a while, like my good self. And they'll have fond memories. I did ask a Twitter question. We'll come to that at the end there. But... It's something that you look back on the fond times, the good memories and so on. I've written homesickness versus nostalgia there. Okay, so is nostalgia a sort of homesickness? But I've written there that homesickness is about a place. It's about wanting to go home, clearly, literally, the basic word. And you can often do that. If it's a place, you can go there. Nostalgia, I suppose, is homesickness, but for time. It's wanting to go back somewhere in the past, and that obviously becomes a lot more difficult without, blue police boxes and whatnot. In general, you can't go back to a time in the past as easily as you can go back to a place that you've been to before. So nostalgia carries with it a much more, melancholy sort of thing. It becomes a much more difficult thing to deal with and relate to. It's all about memories and about trying to chase and recapture things that have gone, maybe. And in a way that is often very unsatisfying. So I've written rose-tinted there, exaggeration, tricks of memory. So, and subject versus object. So nostalgia is very much a case of you had to be there. It's the memories. It's what you the experiences that happened to you a long time ago.
Yeah.
Favourable ones, obviously. And generally, they'll be the ones that were so good they stick in the long-term memory because, you don't remember everything that happens to you constantly. Well, some people do. Weird people with, superpowers. But often those time itself becomes a bit of an enemy. Then the memory is essentially a biological mechanism. Memories fade, they change. You don't quite remember it just exactly the way it is. Hence the term rose-tinted glasses. You do remember it, but the edges go a bit fuzzy. You tend to forget the annoyances and irritations that came with those particular experiences and memories. And obviously, nostalgia is an immensely personal thing as well, subject versus object. I mean, you're remembering an objective thing that actually took place, an event, a happening. Maybe other people were there as well, but odds are they're all going to remember it slightly differently because you're applying your own filter of perception, your own impressions on that event, and between those things, your impressions of it, the lens, the prism that is you, and the objective event itself. That's what forms the nostalgic memory.
Also, every time you reaccess a memory, you change it.
Is that true?
Yeah.
So that can't be helping either. So no. try not to remember stuff too much or you'll
don't
break
concentrate
it.
On anything, otherwise you ruin it.
But so
wise words for life.
Yes. So obviously nostalgia is an immensely personal thing, but there are a lot of common elements there. I've written down their common cultural heritage. I've written an old kids TV show chat. Who's not been in a pub with friends of a similar age to them, and the conversations invariably drifted around to, do you remember Bagpuss? And off you go.
I've got them on DVD.
It's a bit different for you, really, isn't it? You live it all in the present.
Yeah.
But that's kind of, do you remember such and such?
In the first episode, really.
Do you remember Spangles? Do you remember White Dog Poo?
Channel 5 output programming on a Friday night.
Exactly. That's where I was going. It's that sort of D-list celebrities all talking at the camera about 30-year-old kids' TV shows, and weren't they great?
Do you know they got paid £250 just to do that?
Wow, we're in the wrong business.
I know.
Yeah, well, I'm doing that right here, right now. So hopefully there'll be, but you can get paid £250 for falling off a ladder in front of a camera. So it's horses for courses.
It's a lot easier to just read what you're given on a show.
Fair enough. But yeah, so the idea that there are certain nostalgic experiences which we can are so culturally mainstream that we can use them to break the ice in awkward social situations. If you're with some mates, you're drinking in a pub and you run out of things to talk about, someone will go on about, do you remember The Great Escape? Oh, it was brilliant. Dam Busters, Jumpers for Goalposts, all this, You start to sort of cast around for shared common experiences in the past. And that must apply to gaming, surely. Everyone's got those raid stories. They've got the. Do you remember when we were there when the servers were turned off for XMMO, this sort of thing? I mean, we've all got. I mean, you know, just speaking as our own little mumble gang. I mean, there's a select number of us who will just twitch and curl up in horror when anyone sings "Here Come the Girls," and you were there, weren't you? Yes, you know that one. And yes, but that's not going to mean a lot to anyone who wasn't there. So it's an interesting sort of thing that you can have different overlapping sets of nostalgia that sometimes hit and sometimes don't. I've written game equivalent there, yeah. So social cohesion and tribes, does that define a peer group? Shared cultural experiences, shared nostalgias, shared history? I don't know. I mean, it's certainly something that's bonded our little gaming gang on the Mumble channel there with, you know, things that we've done together in the past. And, you know, we've a lot of us have been hanging out together for quite some time in various MMOs, and those sorts of group-based experiences are the ones, the anecdotes that stick.
Well, that's where MMOs work.
Yes, absolutely. You sort of tap into this sort of this whole social area that just does. But then I think single player games can have that experience as well. Everyone remembers the helicopter bit from Half-Life.
Oh yes,
there you go. See, look, that exact. Yeah. Oh yes, you see, I can see it in your eyes. I saw your head went back, your mouth opened, and you just went. Yeah, because it bing.
Rocket launcher.
Yeah, exactly. There's a section in the first Half-Life game where you're running around. You know, you're basically a bloke with a gun, Gordon Freeman there. And there's a section where you get suddenly you're being attacked by a bunch of army guys, and then they send a helicopter after you. And then what follows is about four or five carefully paced levels where you're utterly powerless against it and just being chased. And then you find a rocket launcher, and the payback is such an immensely satisfying, well planned narrative turn that it sticks in the memory. To the point where people can have, you can, like, do you remember the helicopter in Half-Life 1? And bing, there it goes. Yeah. You know, it's almost like a sort of pseudo-telepathy, a way of shortcutting a whole long setup and explanation, because you've got these very powerfully memorized shared experiences, which any of us can access by, you know, asking the right kind of question and in some way synchronizing our thoughts and bringing a conversation into a sort of shared channel, as it were, I suppose. It's an interesting thing. Interesting. So, but yeah, so I've written that in quotes. Do you remember that time? ... Is that's precisely that kind of nostalgic thing. So let's have a look at some particular. I've got some case studies here. Then let's talk about some specifics. So the first one I come up with was Elite.
Yes.
So now I picked Elite because Elite is very, very much a sort of almost archaeological thing.
Yeah.
It spans it was one of the first computer games as we understand the term. I mean, yes, you can talk about TV tennis and Mario Brothers and whatever, but the very first sort of proper home gaming computers would be things like this good here, Spectrum. And the range of games for those was quite varied. There was quite a lot about, but a lot of it was quite forgettable. Name 10 Spectrum games.
Jetpack, Lunar Jetman.
You're just doing the Houston catalogue, aren't you? Yeah. Exelon, Cybernoid.
No, it's really easy. Yeah.
Not really.
The Dizzy games.
Dizzy. Well, yeah, but you
Head Over Heels.
There was a
Batman,
lot.
I remember Batman.
Back when they used to sell computer games in Boots, the chemists, and W.H. Smith's, you'd buy them as audio cassettes. I don't want to go off.
Americans,
please
tune out now.
Americans. It was called the TSR 1000.
Yeah, no, it wasn't really a thing.
It wasn't
America
a thing.
Was.
They went straight to the NES.
No, it was the Commodore 64 more in America. Oh,
okay.
And also,
anyway, yeah. Well, this is going to be a whole show full of digressions. Anyway, but one of the most standout games, and one of the things that absolutely blew us away at the time. Remember, we're talking 1984, 85 here. Was Elite Firebird
the first
Software's
real
Elite
open world game.
In so many ways. I don't know what there was in the way of flight simulators in that sort of time period.
I know Microsoft Flight Simulator was around. Well, pre-Microsoft Flight Simulator.
There may have been something comparable. Essentially, this was a space simulator game where you flew a spaceship around wherever you liked, around a fully realised 3D universe. And we're talking multiple galaxies, hundreds and hundreds of star systems. I mean, obviously, I'm stretching the definition a bit, as you might see on some of the background video we've got going on here. But and this is what I was saying about archive.org. You can actually play Elite in its original form now. Is it MAME, I think, is the emulator that you can embed into a website page, and that's what archive.org's
them, yeah.
got.
Yeah.
And yeah, you can have a go yourself right now.
Or there's a thousand other. Go to World of Spectrum and other places, and that they have other ones as well.
Yeah. So you can look at Elite in two ways. You can look at it from the perspective of a 41-year-old blowhard who's wasted most of his life and just sits there going, oh, do you remember that time? Or you can look at it right now, we're having never played it at all, and just go to this website and look at it for the first time.
Yeah.
And I guarantee you'll find two utterly different games there.
Just out of interest,
and one of you will be hugely disappointed.
Just out of interest, yes? I don't know what's coming up. Is there a certain recently released PlayStation 4 game going to be mentioned in a bit?
No.
Give me a shout when it's appropriate to mention that game.
Okay. But so we've got Elite here, which is it's a 30-year-old game, and the rest, and it utterly blew us away. Do you remember ... which is essentially the very nuts and bolts of nostalgia. Do you remember writing lists of commodity prices on bits of paper for each star system? Yes. Lave, Daiso, Reedquat, Leetsy, and then food, slaves, textiles, etc. You know, you would actually write down, you'd get so engrossed and so involved in wanting to be the best space merchant possible that you would actually start this, you know, in an era well before spreadsheets were commonly available in the household home, you would sit there with pen and paper and graph paper and actually make notes of prices. Of course, the original Elite was not clever enough to have dynamic prices. I think they were just fixed everywhere.
No, they shifted.
Did they move?
I think they shifted, yeah. Wow. But it was based on your use.
Yeah, you were the only actor on that economy, so yeah. So you did have to move around a bit. But yeah, so you would basically end up with this big smudged pencil grid of numbers with all the different prices on so that you could work out decent trade routes.
You remember, and this is very specific,
sitting
in my bedroom when we were quite young, playing Elite on my 1640.
Oh, Elite God.
Plus.
Wow, yeah, we'd probably only just met then.
Yeah.
yes, because you were very odd. You had a PC before PCs were a thing, and you had a number of games for it as well, which I didn't quite believe until I saw, yeah. No, my introduction to it was on the trusty Plus 2 here.
Was it? Or actually, no. Us again. Mm. Was your introduction on the Plus 2, or was it in Computer Club at school?
Oh, I remember seeing it there. Oh, BBC Model B.
BBC Model B. I thought I would have got one of my Model Bs out of the lot.
So the BBC Model B was actually the first version of it, wasn't it? It came onto the Spectrum afterwards. Who had a BBC Model B at home? They were almost exclusively a school teaching aid.
But there was a copy of Elite floating around school.
Mm. But it was this absolutely mind-blowing thing back, you know, having not seen any computer games that you'd recognise the term today. This was, I mean, the contemporary around the time was sort of Manic Miner, essentially 2D scrollers that were murder difficult, and you know, that was basically it. They were all like little platform games or text adventures with very bad vector line art if you were lucky. And suddenly there's this thing here which lets you fly a spaceship between the stars. It wasn't just space trading, there was combat as well. You could buy various different guns for the spaceship. It wasn't sophisticated enough to let you fly different sorts of spaceship. You're always in the Cobra Mark III, but later, I think Elite 2 it let you buy other ships and so on. But it was really, really, genre-defining, epoch-making, whatever. I mean, I've written more notes here. I've got hours spent. Yeah, must have spent hours and hours and hours playing. I mean, you know, in the same way that I game now, I suppose I'd conservatively estimate that I spend perhaps two hours a night on average most of the week. So I'd say I'd probably spend about 15 to 20 hours a week gaming generally. Mm. I mean, a bit less these days because I'm developing outside interests like a proper grown-up and stuff. But
no more talk about running.
I know. I'm going to give you all a rest on that, lady. Listen, I've achieved that. That's done. Tick.
There may well be another caption around this.
but yeah, I must have been playing, because I was a school kid back then, you know, I didn't have much to do in the evenings. I wasn't a terribly social, outdoorsy, football-y type of kid back then. So I probably would have been playing computer games in my bedroom on the Spectrum Plus 2 there for at least 14 or more hours a week. And what can you do with that? It would have been Elite over and over for a big, long span.
No, there's an awful lot of getting in from school with that new C90 you're
talking about. Passing illicit C90s stuffed with games around the playground, so I would have spent hours playing that. There are bits of paper prices, obviously. Urban Legends. Do you remember talk about generation ships? I think they appeared in the manual. There was talk of these giant ships that were out there, and I never found one, but there was mystique.
There was different things in different versions, there was some things which never appeared in any.
There was a lot of stuff that was written about in the manual that probably was just flavour text and was not actually in the game. I don't know. But this was a game that had so impactful. It had mythology.
Yeah.
Actually had myths growing up around it. I mean, you know, we didn't really have internet. We didn't have, you know, forums and ways to meet people of our own interests. It was generally chat, you know, the nerdy kids at school would hide in the corner of the playground and chat about computer games. And we'd all have our theories. We'd all brag and claim to have seen things that we hadn't just to get kudos, you know. But just the idea that one simple game like Elite could generate that kind of sort of legends and mythology and stuff is astonishing. I've written Thargoid anecdotes. The Thargoids were real. I think you could force it to happen if you fired with a military laser whilst doing hyperspace and pressed something else. I don't know. There was a way to force the Thargoid invasion.
I used to farm them.
Well, yeah, once you got the admittedly very limited tech tree sorted out with military lasers and all the missiles and all the rest of it, you could then start taking on these things, and that was I'm trying to think of the use of the phrase end game as applied to a 1984 gaming experience.
There was no mid game.
There was barely any game at all, as you can probably see as we're on the video there. So I've written next to it actually awful. So this isn't so. I'm not going to be popular. So I actually did play it. You're watching my attempt now, and I got on this website, had a go. It's essentially the same. For starters, I couldn't remember what any of the keys were. That didn't help. So I basically launched from a station. I'd forgotten to buy any cargo.
Yeah, rookie mistake.
I know, but I thought, well, I'm just going to. I just about managed to hyperspace to the next star over, get to the planet, get to the starbase, and then I just splashed against the letterbox because 30 years of not practicing that quite finessed and delicate manoeuvre is too long. My co-host here maintains that he can do it without thinking, but I'm not seeing him doing it. So, but there was each star system had one planet and one star and one star base. All the star bases were the same, I think, certainly in the Spectrum version. I think there were dodecahedron ones in some of the more advanced versions for the 16 bits or whatever. But
the Archimedes version being the most advanced.
Yes, yeah. But there really was nothing there. Occasionally, as you're travelling from your warping point to the planet, you'd see a ship coming the other way, and it might be hostile or it might be just another trader, and you could attack those and scoop their cargo, and that was basically about it. There was a fuel scoop to get fuel from the sun, and yeah, that was pretty much it. I mean, as I'm flying into the doomed attempt to dock on this space station, I'm seeing the sun and stars through the starbase, which is not helping at all. It is literally wireframe graphics with no polygons whatsoever.
And this is the Spectrum version. It has been made very clear.
Yeah, I mean, later versions of it started to have filled-in ships and ships with actual panels
Elite,
and stuff.
I still maintain Elite Plus is one of the better versions.
I think that was one where they'd gone a bit, done the extra mile and filled it all in and
VGA
had colours and things as well. It's all basically monochrome.
MCJ.
There's some colours on the HUD, but it is such an utter... I mean, viewed with objective modern eyes, is such a minimal experience that it barely qualifies for the term game. So obviously, in the interests of research and science and prep for this show, I then immediately patched up and fired up Elite Dangerous. So this is the 2014 reboot... remake, whatever you want to call it, the recent one by Frontier Developments, and it is the same people. They were called Firebird Software back then.
No, they weren't called Firebird. Well,
that was the publisher. Yeah. Right? Okay, but yeah, is it Bell and Braben or just
Braben? Just Braben. Bell and Braben fell out a long time.
Bell went
ago.
Off in a huff or something.
Yeah, now it's just Braben.
So Braben. Yeah, so basically, it is literally the same guy who has 30 years later put together a Kickstarter, crowdfunded it a bit, and made the same game again, only with modern technologies, modern aesthetics. And you can see some video of that probably now. And this is me essentially doing the same manoeuvre. I must have logged off in the middle of space last time, so I didn't launch. But I basically hyperspace to another system and dock. And it's so much more pleasant, so much easier. It's more interesting. Everything looks gorgeous. I've got a lot more control over the spaceship.
Yeah.
The strafing keys. I'd have died killed for strafing back
then.
Yeah,
and you're using at this point, you should point out, mouse.
Yes, I have a mouse, which is a new innovation since 1985. And generally, you know, in almost any kind of objective, I mean, if you've got a bunch of reviewers to do some Metacritic work on these two games side by side, having seen neither of them, I imagine Elite Dangerous would probably score a bit higher than Elite.
Ever first flight.
Yes, and you can use its age as an excuse, but as objectively viewed experiences, without the hindsight and the nostalgia, Elite is terrible. 1985 Elite is really bad, as you'd expect, because, you know, computer games were in their infancy then, and we didn't have hardly any of the niceties of modern gaming life. But we're still having these stories. Do you remember when? And fond memories and looking back. And in some ways, I wish I'd never actually had a go at this Elite, because it's you know, having seen it in the cold light of modern day, it's damaged my own memories of enjoying it previously. There's no way I'd play that now. And, you know, and to be fair, and possibly for some somewhat unrelated reasons, I think I decided that I couldn't really be bothered with Elite Dangerous either. But that's more of a modern day game judgment decision, and we talked about that on previous shows when we reviewed it properly. So perhaps the whole experience. See, that I think when we were actually reviewing Elite Dangerous, I mentioned that one of the problems I had with it is that essentially it is 1985 gameplay being sold today into today's gaming audience. And there's not a lot to do in there. They've got power play, and they've got driving on planets and stuff, and that's not really the original game.
This is where I want to mention No Man's Sky.
Yes, go on.
Because it is exactly the same thing. It is 1980s gameplay with modern graphics.
Yes, you were talking about No Man's Sky, and the Commander Blood popped into my head.
Yes.
A really, really old game, which is broadly similar. You travel around this massive galaxy meeting aliens and trying to decipher an alien language, and I think you're chasing after 8 clones of yours after a hyperspace accident, trying to re-merge them back into
Commander
you to survive.
Blood without the game.
Yeah, and you had this sort of like wireframe planet landing sequences, and then you had to find an alien at the end of it. Yeah, I thought I'd seen some of this No Man's Sky stuff before. And yeah, Commander Blood wasn't much more recent than Elite, the original Elite. That would have been sort of late 80s, probably.
No Man's Sky is very much an 80s, early 90s classic traditional game.
And also the art design of No Man's Sky is very Chris Foss. It's very sort of 80s, 70s sci-fi paperback novel covers.
Yeah,
you know,
what we always imagined Elite would look like.
I always thought that style was really quite cool, but that again is a nostalgia thing and again is a retro thing. It's me harking back to ancient dog-eared copies of Robots of Dawn
and Homeworld.
Asimov. Homeworld again is another. Well, Homeworld is another retro.
Yeah, Homeworld's a retro thing because Homeworld got a re-release, which didn't do particularly
well. The original Homeworld was a nostalgic homage to that old school style of ship design and Chris Foss covers and all the rest of it again. So it permeates and pervades a lot of our modern gaming.
There's an awful lot looking backwards.
Yes, yes. Okay, so let's move on to another case study then. So this is another one I thought of when I was thinking about this. I thought about, what about EverQuest? So EverQuest, not everyone's played it, not everyone knows about it, but everyone's played an MMO that owes a lot to EverQuest, because EverQuest 1999, we're talking about now, we've skipped forward a bit, it was my first MMO experience, my first experience of a large-scale online game with many, many other players. I mean, there were sort of lobby games before that, X-Wing versus TIE Fighter, a couple of other sort of pseudo MMOs that never went anywhere, but EverQuest was really the first big breakout onto the scene for me, and for many people, many players indeed. It was a popular game in its day. Now, you've got to remember, in the days before World of Warcraft blew everything out of the water and totally redefined the market, EverQuest, at its peak, got about 300,000 players.
Yeah.
So and that was the days when subscription was the only way to play. There was none of this free-to-play stuff going on. So, you know, a third of a million players is that was astronomical in those days. And we genuinely had... It's another, do you remember? Do you remember having those conversations where you thought nothing would ever beat EverQuest?
Yes.
It was the big daddy on the scene. You know, this is well before World of Warcraft.
Yeah, it turned up, it decimated Ultima.
Its main rivals at the time were Ultima Online, that was just going through the Second Age, which was its sort of main big first major expansion revamp thing. And I think Asheron's Call was well into its stride at that point as well.
But Meridian
59 never
really.
It probably has the technical right to call itself the first, but it never really caught the imagination and the scale that the original EverQuest is. And of course, Sony Online Entertainment and obviously what are now Daybreak Games have basically been dining out on EverQuest's original cult success ever since, and been trying to chase that success and recapture it, and not really doing that well. I don't believe, and I'm sort of slightly making up numbers that I've seen on graphs on other people's blogs and things, but I don't believe EverQuest 2 ever eclipsed EverQuest 1 in terms of numbers.
I don't think it ever did.
It was a really spectacularly misjudged design decision anyway. Let's totally split our player base. Half of the people who don't want to move and half of the people who want something better.
There are people listening to this who would know.
Yeah.
But they're not going to say.
It doesn't matter. This is all anecdotes anyway. But the point being is that EverQuest So Earthquakes back then was a massive thing, and I literally ran up multi-thousand-pound phone bills in the days before unmetered internet access playing this thing. It was an obsession. I had a job at the time, and I didn't have any major outgoings because I was still living with parents, but so I paid my own phone bill, and clearly on some level thought it was worth it. But that was the level of obsession and addiction, and I put loads of time into this thing. I'm not going to have another post-traumatic PvP server breakdown again. That's irrelevant to what we're talking about here. But the idea of a whole world of fantasy where I could literally go and escape. I could be Legolas. I could be Aragorn. You know, it's what all my trashy novel reading up to that point had been leading up to. And here I was in a computer reality that let me do it all. And I've played it since. I've had a lot of fond memories of EverQuest. And of course, you know, being the sort of person who won't leave a sore tooth alone but has to keep poking it with your tongue, I've on occasion attempted to go back and rediscover my roots, go back and find that. And you can. EverQuest is still a going concern. It is still playable. It is free to play at the moment. It's Daybreak Games have got it. I think it's about one of the three games Daybreak Games is currently still pushing. They've got EverQuest 2. I think they still do DCUO and Planetside 2, and that's it. I think they've canned everything else.
Possibly.
And I don't even know what DCUO's proper status is.
Isn't there DayZ or whatever?
I don't know.
Was that them?
Oh, it could be them. Survival. Yeah, whatever. Yeah. But anyway, after all this time, and I think it's gotten to the point where EverQuest is just too big to fail. You know, it must have on some level a regular player base. That's because they keep running it, keep maintaining it. Yeah. They haven't shuffled it off quietly like they did with PlanetSide 1. But so you can go and play it, and it is, I don't know. See, this was the thing. I went in there looking for the past and couldn't find it because in the 20-odd years. Are they on 20 years yet? That would be 2019 would be their 20th anniversary. So they're on 17 or so by now, yeah. So in all that time, it has changed. It's never gone through any kind of huge game-wide massive graphical upgrade, but they've tarted up whole zones like sort of Freeport and Neriac and things like that. They've sort of redesigned some of those zones, which effectively means that the nostalgia versus homesickness thing, the idea that it's now in the past and not actually a place I can go to anymore, has kicked in. So now my sort of fond memories have become literally unrecapturable. And the rules changes are different in there. The XP lever has been yanked severely. I've elsewhere on our channel, you can find me having a good old reminisce about EverQuest itself. I don't want to go on about too much there. But the point being...
That's quite popular.
It's our most popular video, in fact. So yeah, go and have a look for that. But so you can see me talking about the details of how EverQuest has changed over the years. But the point being is it has significantly changed. So even if it is literally the first example, Elite versus Elite Dangerous, in that sort of suggests that nostalgia perhaps is a personal thing, and that objectively speaking, progress is generally better. You know, but this shows that even if you keep the same experience in place, it changes still anyway. And to a large extent, so do I. I'm different now. I mean, this is like 15, 17 years ago. I've learned a lot. I've suffered trauma. I've risen up. I'm basically a different person. But you don't notice because you are yourself all the time. You know, someone who only met me 10 years ago and hasn't seen me since would probably think I changed. But you don't see it yourself from inside.
Yeah, you had a weird facial hair 10 years ago.
I was differently facial haired too, yeah. I've written down there, versus EverQuest 2 plus expansion. See, this is something even, and we'll come on to the sort of nostalgia as a business idea as we go, but this is something even Sony have sort of tried to tap into, is the idea that everyone's first experience was EverQuest 1 and they had great times, and how do we get them to pay for more of that? Well, let's do a sequel where they can revisit all the old stuff. Only they sort of misjudged it because they were selling it against the original experience itself, so that all gone a bit weird. But so much of EverQuest 2 is very much, hey, do you remember ...
Yeah.
There are whole zones, whole places, named monsters who are now in ghost form, because EverQuest 2 is set like 500 years after EverQuest 1, big cataclysms, etc., which is why all the continents look different. But there are so many nods in there that they might as well have just redesigned the same game again. The smart money, you know, retrospectively, would have been to upgrade EverQuest 1 massively, just keep it as a major concern. And you'll note that Blizzard and World of Warcraft they haven't done a sequel.
There will never be a Warcraft.
No, but they made record numbers again on their latest expansion sales. You know, they're onto their like 8th or 9th major expansion, and it is just functionally the same game. You know, it's probably changed beyond all recognition since then. And indeed, you do see occasional campaigns to get vanilla World of Warcraft back, We want pre-Burning Crusade. You know, everyone has an opinion on which World of Warcraft expansion ruined everything forever. Most people say it's Cataclysm, but a lot of people think it started to go wrong at Wrath of the Lich King. I know Burning Crusade generally fairly well received. I don't know enough. I left before Burning Crusade, to be honest, but haven't been back since, really. But there's always sort of fringe mutterings about, oh, we want vanilla World of Warcraft back. It was better back then. The rules were harder. There wasn't all this looking for raid finders. There wasn't all this, you know, just push forward to progression. Everyone is susceptible to nostalgia because that's the massive... I mean, even that... do you remember that the news about that private server that Blizzard went out and shut down? It was phenomenally successful. 10,000 players, possibly more. 100,000, maybe. And it was called Nostrilla, I think, which, you know, sort of... I'm pretty sure is sort of playing on the word nostalgia there. And its appeal was being able to go back in time to recapture an earlier thing, which has now changed beyond recognition, which is now beyond reach. So, and yeah, I could see that gaining traction as word and mouth spread, and obviously it gets successful enough, and Blizzard can't just ignore it. They've got to do something, so they stomped on it. And they don't seem to be giving any indication that they're planning on doing vanilla servers. They're going to stand by their expansion progression. They're keeping their game going forwards because presumably they got the metrics and the psychology and know what makes the money. I think a nostalgia thing, as we're finding as we're going through here, I went back to EverQuest 1 in circa 2015 and found it was not what I wanted after all, and I just sort of gave up again. So perhaps vanilla World of Warcraft servers would turn out to be a curiosity, and then everyone would just get bored and go away after they've scratched that itch and realised that you can't go back, perhaps. So in Project 1999 there, so this is a private server that is emulating very early EverQuest 1 rule set. And actually that's had Daybreak Games' blessing. They're allowed to run that. I'm not sure how it stands on earning money from it. Probably that's a no-no. But, you know, Sony have basically, it was Sony back then. Daybreak have basically said that they're fine with it. You do what you like. So you can actually go back and find, you know, the original EverQuest and jump in, and presumably there's a thriving community there. I've seen a lot of the comments on our video are people going, well, you should just go and look for... Because basically, much of that video was me going, oh, it's not the same anymore. And, you know, obviously. And a lot of people in comments going, well, try Project 1999. That is the same. So you could, but I haven't, which is telling in itself.
A lot of people, I think, missed the point, which was...
It's not really about EverQuest. It's about me. Yes. Yeah, I've written EQTube time lock progression servers. Now, this is something that... So we'll come to this when we get to the nostalgia as a business bit, but something that Daybreak are quite canny and clever and understand well is that a lot of their money comes from previous and existing customers. They're not that so driven about getting new people into EverQuest 2 anymore. But how about pretty much every 6 months they go, hey, look, we'll start a new server and we'll only unlock all the expansion content after a certain amount of arbitrary time or voting or whatever. And you can't do that on the free-to-play. That is actually a perk of being an Access member.
Yeah.
So they're basically selling the idea that you can start again on a fresh server with none of the perks or the advancements back like it was in the good old days. And I imagine there's certain fundamental core rule set changes that they probably can't unpick or undo. But on the whole, it is a generally fairly good replication. But the problem is they missed the point of that because EverQuest 2 itself is an advancement on EverQuest 1. I imagine the EverQuest 1 time lock progression server idea might be the thing. But I imagine that's such a legacy code nightmare by now that it's probably not practical. But they actually make a lot of money by offering the nostalgia, offering a way for players with fond memories of the early days of EverQuest 2, you know, and you know that's perhaps the sort of mini generation behind where I'm at, the people who got into, because EverQuest 2 came out at the same time as World of Warcraft, it was the same week, I think, and so that kind of time period, people who started their MMO gaming around then, they'll have the fond first formative memories of original old school EverQuest 2, and that can be thought to have gone forever in all the rules changes and expansions. But hey, how about paying a bit extra and you can come and experience the old days? And they're very popular. They always seem to do well when they launch one of these. I think they're going to burn that out after a while because they keep doing it a bit too frequently. Yeah. But you know, the opportunity to go back in time and see how it was and start fresh, the pioneering spirit is saleable. It is marketable, and Daybreak are very good at doing that. They do it a lot. All right, another case study, Star Wars Galaxies. There's the look again. Do you remember when? Do you remember being mayor of that town?
God,
a trigger warning. Yeah, so when they added player towns in Star Wars Galaxy, everyone's got their own Star Wars Galaxies anecdotes.
And
go look at Raf Costa's blog. He's got some fantastic post-mortems about designing Star Wars Galaxies and what that meant and how it all panned out. There was some fantastic reading, recommended for anyone who's remotely interested in MMOs. But we got our own memories of it. In particular, we started on a fresh server around the time they added the player towns, and we sort of managed to rustle up a kind of pickup town.
Yeah,
it was a weird pickup community. We all went off. We just went to one of the more remote planets that doesn't actually feature in any of the lore particularly. I think it was Talus or something. Because we were generally quite sick of Star Wars at that point. But, you know, the game turned out to be
very... in the comments if you were part of that city.
We'd love to hear from you again. Yeah, we lost touch with pretty much everyone from then. But there was about 20 or 30 regulars who were just soloing players who'd all come to this planet to get away from it all. And we ended up... by a bit of uncharacteristic forward-outward speaking on the planet chat. No, it wasn't even planet chat back then. It was just a custom channel we created and then just tried to encourage people to join to as they passed near the starport. And in the end, we ended up with about 20 or 30 people who were all just using this channel to keep in touch, to exchange goods and services. It was very much a game about interdependent roles and is there any armor smiths about? I'd like some armor. We need a doctor, etc. You know, we had this sort of like small Alaskan town mentality going on this remote part of the world. And then they added player towns, and so we started creating one of those. And I was an architect. I ended up building most of it by hand, one building at a time, with like all 10 harvesters going, and every day I had to go and chase the harvesters. It burnt me out a bit, I have to say.
We need 16 new buildings.
Yeah, on the other hand, you were the mayor. They had a politician profession.
Yeah.
And you
couldn't quit from.
They forgot to put a way of quitting.
If
the only way you could not be a mayor was if someone else got voted mayor.
And no one, who didn't vote counted.
And no one voted you out of office ever. So theoretically,
I mean,
the server's gone now, which I suppose was a bit of a relief. But apart from that,
I did stop playing.
But yes, it burnt us out a bit. It was quite a lot of work. But stuff of nostalgia, memories that will last forever, very formative. That do you remember? ... So and I was listening to 3MMO there, and Petta and Teppa and Jen were talking. Jen and Petta mostly. I don't think Teppa was really that into. Yeah, and Galaxies. But the point is, they got everyone, you know, you got this Star Wars Galaxies, that misty look, that sort of slight faraway thing, and you can hear the diddle in their heads. But, and then everyone ranting about, oh, the NGE, they broke the NGE, the combat upgrade, blah, blah, blah. You know, that everyone has their theories about when it started to go wrong and all the rest of it. And it is a good, again, that sort of social, that tribe forming social cohesion thing. Everyone, you know, we have shared experiences, things we can talk about together. But I'm always rather mystified when people go, oh, I miss Star Wars Galaxies, because it's actually there. You can play it now. There's this project called Star Wars SWGMU, which no one has seen fit to shut down or do anything about, and is functionally complete.
Which is funny, really, because Disney...
It's one of those, I've written there, the posthumous emulator project. Anytime an MMO looks like it's about to shut down, everyone starts going, oh, it's all right, we'll make our own server. You know, and there's like this well-meaning but ultimately technically misguided attempt to try and reverse.
Capture all the data
you can. Start capturing packets, everyone. What? What's a packet? You know, and you know, as if you could just spin off a replica server for the game that's shutting down in, you know, out of string and a bit of gumption. It's almost always an overly optimistic project that goes nowhere. But this SWGMU came about because I think right back at the combat upgrade, which was about 2 or 3 years before it closed, there was a movement who were so dissatisfied with how that went that they started doing the emulator project then, which meant they had about 3 years of running game to do the research and take the data. And what's turned out, I think only in the last sort of half year or so, they've got to the point where I would classify it as feature complete. Now, it doesn't have jumped at light speed, but that's about it. The rest, so the Star Wars Galaxies is there if you want it. If you've got the original discs, and you can go and Google for SWGMU, there is a server there. It's called Basilisk. They've got a test server. The Basilisk server, I connected to get some footage a couple of days ago. It had about 1,000 players on. This was about 8 p.m. midweek. You know, this is not just a whimsical 2 or 3 people can't let it go. This is a functioning server with a community and people and social groups and everything. And most of the core mechanics that I could remember were there. You had your mineral harvesting, all the craftings there, the combat. I did a bit of rifleman headshot sniping, some rabbit things in the wilderness there. It all still works. Player housing, that's all there. All the furniture, pretty much. And most people who really loved Star Wars galaxies and have the stories and the nostalgia and the anecdotes weren't really the sort of power gaming fighty types. They were mostly the people who stood around crafting and chatting and things, or dancing in the cantina. It was very much, it's like I said earlier, the nostalgia is a function not only of the objective gameplay experience, but also of the subjective memories and sociality and group forming and bonds.
It's why a politician class worked.
Yeah, you have a game with a politician class. I mean, yeah, entertainer was a whole set of classes. There was about four different subclasses there, dancer, musician, and it was all designed to be useful, but also functional and social. I'm not going to turn this into a massive, you know, nostalgia about Star Wars Galaxies, but the point being is that if you want to play Star Wars Galaxies now, you can. It's still there. It's still available in a form, you know. Okay, it's not the official servers. No one's shut them down. It's still going. It's a grey area, I suppose, and no one's you know giving out torrents of the game client. You have to have your own from somewhere, and I think you can eBay those. But the point being is that it's the nostalgia is actually more compelling and more, I don't know, comforting, more interesting to most people than just immediately recapturing that base experience. If you'd never played Star Wars Galaxies before and you went and go and had a go now, you'd probably think it was quite poor. Bit like your Elite example at the start there. It's, you know, I mean, it's a bit clunky. The graphics are not anywhere near as good as the Old Republic's graphics, although the gameplay is very, very sandbox. In terms of actual missions, there was mission terminals. You could get two jobs, which was basically walk 300 metres that way and then chuck a grenade in a rabbit nest. Tick, game money. That was it.
Yeah.
There was some theme park stuff, which was sort of proto-questing railroad stuff.
That was hacked on afterwards.
It was not very good, no. No, the point is, it was a world. It was a sandbox. It was an experience and a thing that forms nostalgia. So I've written Lucky Ones End Forever, and I've written City of Heroes there. Now, there are some City of Heroes emulation projects. Some City of Titans, I think, is one, and I think there's some. I can't remember what it's called now. I mean, Dr. Turag would know a lot more about it. But they've got a thing for City of Heroes to the point where you can all log on to Atlas Park and stand there and chat, but there's no combat, no questing, no missions, and no skills or anything. You can't use your powers. So essentially they've created a sort of graphical chat room replacement where you could still be your little dressed up superhero and do the social thing, but most of the game isn't there yet. So, but that's one that had such a powerfully attractive nostalgia that people are motivated enough to do what's essentially quite a technical and difficult reverse engineering job on their own time. And there are attempts to get City of Heroes going again, still ongoing. The final outcome of those we'll have to see, but that's the power of the nostalgia. But then I've written there Lucky Ones End Forever. I mean, as I've found with my sort of, you know, revisit EverQuest and have a go at original Elite, is it perhaps a mercy that your game just disappears, that you literally cannot go back and have another go 20 years later, because that then leaves, I've written untarnished memories there, a clean break.
Yeah,
would you rather
have
cherished precious memories that you can't ever revisit but only in your mind, or would you want to go back to the thing that you loved 20 years ago and find that you're a different person now and it's different and none of it's as good as you remember?
I would always want to be able to go back.
It's a very subjective thing. Okay, so I'm going to quickly go through. So I've got another page here of nostalgia as a business. I've written demand is there, memories to be resold to us, cynical marketing ploy or fulfillment of demand. I've got quite a lot of examples there. So basically, nostalgia is a thing. It's well understood, and clever marketing people can use that to sell us new things and get money out of us. It's, you know, a very powerful advertising technique. You know, do you remember this good thing? Well, look, it's back. Give us some money.
The entire console business is built on this now.
Well, a lot, so much of gaming, as we'll look through. I've got a whole load of examples here. GOG.com.
Yep.
So this is essentially CD Projekt Red, who made The Witcher, which itself was just a sort of modded version of the Neverwinter Nights engine or something. That went well for them, and that gave them enough spare money that they thought, well, I know, let's set up a thing where we basically go out and... Because abandonware's been a thing for a long time, but is essentially piracy, because you're basically giving away games which you think that the rights holders don't know about or don't care about anymore, but probably do if it was popular enough. Because if it's popular enough to be useful abandonware, then potentially money can be made from it. So you're not giving that money to the right person. But so GOG.com go out their way to basically retroactively refit a lot of these old games so they work on modern PCs, and obviously chase down the appropriate rights so that you can legally rebuy these games again. There's other services out there, not quite as high profile and stuff. So I've written under there, whatever happened to the budget re-release? Do you remember those?
They became Game of the Year collection.
Well, I think Steam torpedoed all that because they just do budget re-release of everything.
That's every game 8 months later.
Every game 6 months, yeah. But GOG.com essentially, and they've changed in recent years. Nowadays, they're just a game shop like any other. They sell all the full price stuff. They're even getting into early access now. They've got an in-development tag, you know, very disappointing. But certainly for a long time, and perhaps still today, they are a massive place you can go to find old classics. And they earn money doing that. You know, they're selling these games. They've gone and bought the rights to them. They've tidied them up so they'll work. But, you know, you are paying them for old memories to be able to replay these stuff. Things like Planescape Torment is always on its best-selling list, yes, somewhere in the top 20, you know, consistently. That's a game I choose not to replay anymore.
Really?
I think it won't be any good if I try it again, but it's one of my best games ever, and I have huge, huge fond memories of it, but I'm just scared of trying it now because it probably wouldn't stand up. Remakes, reboots, reimaginings, remasters, spiritual successors and homages. So this is not so much the here is your old memory repackaged and sold to you. It's here is a new thing that we think is a lot like the old thing you really liked. You should probably try this thing as well and give us some money. I've got all sorts of examples here. I've written Doom and Wolfenstein. Wolfenstein in particular, every 2 years there's another Wolfenstein game.
The last Wolfenstein was quite good.
Well, perhaps.
Also, the last Doom was really good.
Yeah, okay. So, but
ones before...
Is that luck?
Not
yeah,
so much.
That's almost nothing to do with the basic original experience. And again, go and look for the original shareware first third of Doom. You can probably still find that out there on archive sites somewhere.
Or you can go along to many, many places and buy it. It's still on Steam. It's on Xbox.
Yeah, you'll need DOSBox to get it going, probably. But you can probably play the original Doom now if you want.
You can still buy it, download it, and run it instantly.
Okay, it's had a tarted up compatibility pass, has it? Yeah. So, but yeah, every couple of years you'll get a new Doom or Wolfenstein game because people know that people have fond memories. The marketing people know that it sells. I've written Fallout 3 and 4 there. Essentially, what other franchises are kicking about that people have cherished fond memories of? The original Fallout and Fallout 2 were very, very seminal games in their day. A lot of people loved them to bits. So along come Bethesda with a vast amount of ZeniMax money and thought, all right, let's have that, yoink. And then they just basically sort of tacked.
They made a completely different game out of it.
They basically reskinned Skyrim or whatever it was at the time. That would have been Oblivion around then.
Fallout
3 came between Oblivion and Skyrim. Did it, or was it before Oblivion? I think after Oblivion.
It was after Oblivion.
Whatever. Yeah, the point being is that they just sort of they reskinned their usual wander around a large bit of countryside simulator with some guns instead of swords, and off we go. No, it turned out to be a very good game, but it wasn't Fallout really.
No, it's completely different.
Had a lot of the original imagery in there, you know, the Pip-Boy and all the rest of it. But essentially, was its own game. It happened to be a good game, and that's fine too. But a lot of the original sales of Fallout 3 would be people going, "Oh, I remember Fallout. I've got to try this." System Shock. I've done a sort of big node chart list here. It's actually more of a diagram for System Shock. So we've got System Shock, System Shock 2. System Shock 2 takes the original thing and adds RPG elements and tries to Hollywood it up a bit with story and things. And I've got Bioshock because they couldn't get the rights for System Shock 3 and that all went a bit weird. Then Bioshock 2, Bioshock Infinite.
Did
you link me that tweet about was it Lee Alexander's review of Bioshock Infinite? That was quite a read. I'd recommend looking for that.
I do not like Bioshock Infinite, she sums it up perfectly.
I've never played it, and I'm not going anywhere near it now. I'm not going to go into that now because it's off topic. So we've got System Shock 3 ? There's talk of another System Shock with the rights all back where they belong and so on. And then there was that System Shock 1 remaster kickstart thing that I was raving about a couple of episodes back as well. So this is this one nostalgic experience, which was System Shock itself, which is in itself was basically Die Hard in space.
It's not even that original. It's a nostalgia node.
It's like a gobstopper, yeah. And somewhere in the middle is an original idea, yeah. But that original idea would have happened about 15 years ago and been hazed out of all recognition by our rosy-tinted goggles. I've written Dishonored and put an arrow to Thief. I've got Arx Fatalis and an arrow to Underworld. This is something Arkane Studios do, which is basically they are obviously of a similar outlook to me in that they've got these games they played in the past that they really loved, only they're a development game studio, so they can actually go and do something about it. And a lot of the games they make are quite thinly veiled love letters to old nostalgic experiences. The modern games are not necessarily, it's not a bad thing necessarily, these games are very good, but they owe a lot of what they are and subsequently a lot of their sales to the fact that they're tapping into something we hold precious from a long time ago. I've got an MMO section here as well then. So the progression server, you talked a bit about this, the EQ2 unlock the unlock the expansions as you go with voting. It is absolutely a nostalgia trip. No one today approaching MMOs for the first time is going to give a toss about EverQuest.
No.
They'll go to
no.
World of Warcraft or whatever the current modern shiny is, like Elder Scrolls or Black Desert Online. I'd lose track myself now, help. But, you know, you don't sort of approach a new hobby or interest and go, right, what were people 30 years doing? You'll look at it and go, what are people today doing?
Yeah.
What's the modern thing? That's where I get involved. So any of these appeals to the old stuff resold or remastered or, you know, tarted up or whatever, is by very necessity absolutely dependent on nostalgia for sales. I've written Blizzard resistance to vanilla rules server. Legion Arrow Burning Crusade. I'm totally bluffing here, but is the mod this Legion expansion very Burning Crusade-y? Dunno, writing in comments. None of it. We don't have a World of Warcraft expert on staff.
No, I'm just going out with one.
You should probably ask, tweet and see if we can get an answer before I finish ranting. I've written DDO here. Now, this is a textbook nostalgia U-turn. So DDO launched with the Eberron world, which was what they were sort of bundling as their new pulp noir detective, but with magic crystals and golems and privatized type world to go with 3.5 D&D and 4 D&D. And it wasn't successful. No one really got into it. I personally quite liked it. I found it refreshing and interesting. All these weird, wacky, magical floating crystals everywhere and modern concepts like the lightning rail, steam trains, but powered by lightning elementals. That sounds cool. No. So what we get is Forgotten Realms expansion. Big fanfare, big fuss. Oh, look, we've got the license to Forgotten Realms. So, and you have to get to like level 15 or 20 or so with your character before you're even allowed to set foot through the magical portal that takes you across the plains to the Forgotten Realms. Forgotten Realms, which predates Elite. You know, Forgotten Realms is like 1980s rule books for second edition D&D.
I'm thinking 82.
Possibly, yeah. It's an ancient and absolutely vanilla high swords and sorcery fantasy setting, and designed that way on purpose. When you're designing a campaign world for your players to buy the gump for and plan their adventures in, you don't want the world to be so terrifyingly interesting.
It was 87.
87, wow. Okay. But yeah, it needs to be a boring vanilla world because you want your GMs and players to put the interesting stuff in there. You don't want the world itself to be so fascinating that there's no room for creativity of your own. But no, you know, lots of players playing DDO going, oh, I miss Baldur's Gate. Baldur's Gate. Nostalgia. Do you remember Baldur's Gate? Yeah. There goes the look again. He's so easy to trigger. Baldur's Gate, a seminal classic of the genre. It brought actual pen and paper to the computer, so we didn't need friends or to imagine things, and that was nice. But, you know, pretty much every fantasy RPG since Baldur's Gate has been trying to recapture and trying to hook into that in some fashion or another, including Dungeons & Dragons Online, which is why they splurged for the Forgotten Realms license and then massively retooled it all. Oh, we don't care about Eberron anymore because it's just not connecting with our target demographic, who are basically all 30-something people going, oh, do you remember Baldur's Gate?
Where's Grizzed?
Yeah, exactly. So you got this. Suddenly you end up with this massive Forgotten Realms based expansion for the mid to high levels, and most of their development going onward has gone from there. You don't get any new Eberron content these days, I don't think. I'm not an expert, but do comment. And as I've learned recently on three MMOsketeers, that's not three, is it? It's just MMOsketeers. Whatever, the thing that Teppo and Jen do with news.
You should really know this.
I know. They were talking about the fact that DDO and planning a Ravenloft excursion.
Ooh.
Now. See, look, there's the look again. Do you remember? .. I mean, you know, personally, talk to me when they get the Planescape license, but they are going...
Oh, Dark Souls.
They're off again, basically. Yeah, exactly. We probably will, you know, because they worked out that nostalgia sells. People remember Ravenloft because they played D&D back in the 80s. They remember Forgotten Realms. They have no idea what Eberron is. That was a spectacularly ill-advised decision to do that in the first place, probably. They should have gone with Forgotten Realms from the word go if they could have done. But so we're going to be getting Ravenloft as DDO. And that, again, nostalgia. Again, it's tapping into people's memories and fantasies and trying to present some kind of thing. I've got some side notes there. And Neverwinter, you know, the Neverwinter game, Ark. They added Minsk recently.
Okay.
I don't even know how that works. There's like, because I'm very hazy on that. So Neverwinter is set in the Forgotten Realms, which is probably the reason that DDO couldn't get Forgotten Realms for a while. But they just added Minsk as a bloke who gives you missions and you can talk to in the town square. You know, the comedy barbarian with the mutant giant space hamster from Baldur's Gate. You know, again, nostalgia. Again, it's harking back to the past. So I've written SWTOR there, just a side note. I've written SWTOR brackets stuffed with KOTOR. Now, that's perhaps excusable because it is sort of theoretically kind of the third in the KOTOR series, but it is absolutely an MMO, an entire MMO hinging its popularity and sales and success on people going, oh, do you remember Knights of the Old Republic? Do you remember Revan? You know, do you remember the big twist with Revan?
Everyone remembers.
Everyone knows the big twist with Revan. I'm not going to spoil it just in case. But, you know, pretty much since launch, pretty much everywhere in SWTOR, you look here, we can go to this planet and see the wreck of the spaceship that crashed in the beginning of the Old Republic. You know, Knights of the Old Republic. You know, here's a whole load of stuff about Revan. Hey, do you remember Revan, kids? You know, it's like bang, 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 over and over. Keep pushing that nostalgia, nostalgia, nostalgia. And does that come at a cost? I think it perhaps does.
I think it does.
So let's talk about crowdfunding briefly. So I've written Pillars of Eternity there.
Yes.
So, and I've drawn an arrow to Baldur's Gate on my little chart there.
Oh, definitely.
And that's on purpose as well. Now, Pillars of Eternity crowdfunded. This wasn't a big AAA studio like Obsidian or someone deciding, right, here's the next cash cow. We're going to milk some nostalgia. It's a couple of people came up with an idea. Let's make a game that's just really like Baldur's Gate. And then they, of course, we're now in the age of Kickstarter and the age of crowdfunding. Publishers are not quite so important anymore. You don't have to impress a venture capitalist who's a bit nervous about nostalgia swinging the whole business. So you can just go straight to the player base and go, hey, do you remember Minsk? ... And they'll go, yes, I remember Minsk. Here's $25. Here's like $150 for a stretch goal or whatever. Pillars of Eternity made $4 million. Out of donations, out of misty-eyed throwbacks like my good self. I don't kickstart generally, but you went for that one. That was one of yours. Okay, it delivered. Apparently, it's a very good game.
It's a very good game. You should play it.
Is it substantially different to Baldur's Gate? Is there not enough to hurt?
No.
You know what you wanted, and you got what you wanted.
Exactly.
Yes. So it's, again, nostalgia perhaps not a bad thing. But if you were to try and play Baldur's Gate right now, I think you'd find that a tricky experience, especially considering it runs in 640 by 480.
I tried playing the first bit of Baldur's Gate a couple of years ago, and
I found not
get very far.
Yeah, I think there was a show not so long ago where I did something similar, and I found that I rolled a wizard and got one hit by an arrow twice and had to restart.
Yeah.
You know, it is a hard game, and it's an old game, and perhaps Pillars of Eternity might be a better bet. I've written Elite Dangerous there. £22 million they got, I think. I think that's their projected sales for, you know, the end of this whatever. And that's basically, there's no publisher involved there particularly.
The publisher.
Yeah, you know, that was all crowdfunded. Most of that was advanced stuff. It was people keeping the faith and just throwing the money and hoping for the
best.
And
it was very successful. They managed to recreate Elite.
It is.
And whether or not people got upset that they managed to recreate Elite.
It achieved its aim, yeah, absolutely. But it is held up as a success story for kickstarting. I've got Star Citizen there. There's no talking about crowdfunding without talking about the elephant in the room. I got 123 million. That was according to Wikipedia. It's probably about double that by now since I wrote that number down.
Yeah, an hour ago.
But I've written Arrow joining Wing Commander and Privateer there. So
yeah.
Star Citizen itself, you know, the big hoo-ha, the grand poobah of crowdfunding, is itself another nostalgic trip.
It is, yeah.
And these are often projects by visionaries of like 20 or 30 years ago who want another go at doing the thing, but with modern tech. And why wouldn't you want to do that? That's a noble goal. But they obviously don't feel they can take that to a AAA publisher and make a convincing case for large-scale venture capital. So they have to go straight to the nostalgic heartstrings, straight to a website, straight to a, do you remember, ... And it works for them, they get the money, and sometimes they actually do the thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know about Star Citizen, a lot of people calling that trolling and a scam, but I think that's just impatient people who aren't very rational.
I don't know, I'm very patient. But
I think some people will be there, but perhaps it won't be what people have built it up to be.
I'm looking forward to the bits of it and not other bits.
But what we can see from these things is that there is a huge market in nostalgia, a huge market in finding out what we cherish from the past and then repackaging and selling it back to us again. And I wonder, because I think that must come at a cost. Does that damage development? Does that damage innovation? Is innovation the enemy of nostalgia? You don't want things to change from the past.
But does it also go backwards and pick up features which have been forgotten?
Could be. Oh, I forgot my patch. My post-it note fell off. I've written Lotro on the post-it note. Now, that's an interesting one because you've got nostalgia going on two levels there. So you got there's a nostalgia for the works of Tolkien.
Yes.
I remember running around the Shire going, wow, it's perfect. Look, they've even got the right number of white steps, because I was reading through the Lord of the Rings at the same time, just because you would do, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
And pretty much all of the Shire, actually everywhere that they follow the journey of the Fellowship, it is pretty much book perfect. It really, really does hit the spot, and you think, wow, this is amazing. And then you end up in places like the North Downs and Enedrath, and, you know, places that are just distant names on the map that are never mentioned by any major character, let alone visited.
Yeah, please do not fill this in.
And they are totally hub-to-hub questing MMO zones like normal, and you think, okay. But, you know, you get this huge fanboy squee thing going on as you're running through the Shire delivering pies and seeing the inn and the Bywater and all the rest of it. And that is nostalgia crossing the media. You've basically got a computer game tapping into nostalgia for something that's not even about gaming. And that somehow seemed to work. It shifted a lot of copies. I think they probably sold a lot more because it was Lord of the Rings than if they just invented it as Asheron's Call 3 or whatever. But then also you got this other thing I've written down there, which was odd. Nostalgia for the starter area within the game. I found that once I was at around level 60 and being sent off to like Isengard and all the rest of these like obviously tacked on MMO style zones, I was really missing going back. I wanted to be in the Shire delivering pies and stuff again, but obviously progression in level mechanics in MMOs means there's nothing for me to do back there again apart from roleplay. So I ended up missing parts of my own internal gaming experience. I'd been playing LOTRO for on and off for a couple of years, and I missed the early part of the MMO when it was new and fresh, and the starter zone was a fantastic homage to the source material.
When it was a lot more Tolkien.
And when there were lots more players and friends of mine were playing it, that kind of thing. So you end up with nostalgia happening within your own, within one linear experience, which is strange. And that was something that's peculiarly unique to LOTRO, I find. But then most MMOs, you're going to yearn for the early days when it was simple, when the starter zone was fresh, when you didn't have to, you know, do the raiding schedule or worry about +1% end game gear, whatever. Nostalgia within itself. Odd. So I got my big summing up page there. Anyway, I've written the future of nostalgia. Do you see what I did there?
I do.
That's quite clever. Yeah, I've written. This is my weird bunch of rhetorical questions. Then let's see. Are we pioneers of video game nostalgia? Are we the first? So this is more specifically aimed at you and my good self. We're in our sort of early 40s now, and there are a lot of our peers and gaming buddies who are in a similar place. Are we the people for whom computer gaming was the earliest possible childhood experience? We were about 11, 12 gaming started.
There's a generation above us, by a generation I mean a couple of years above us.
Yeah, yeah.
Who were the people who tended to be more in control there. I think we were the people who were young enough while
we were
other
childlike.
People were making stuff.
Yeah, we were childlike when games were first.
Yeah,
we're the first generation
where we were kids when it came out.
Yes. And
by a couple of years only. But
yeah, yeah. So I wonder, we're at the cutting edge of tedious nostalgia and reminiscence in this manner.
I think we are.
I wonder about kids today. What are they going to see? What are they going to be nostalgic about? Do you remember Pokemon Go, where you had to walk around with one of those phone things? This was back before neural implants.
Oh, yeah, but Pokemon Go being the ultimate 90s kids nostalgia.
I don't know. I wonder how future generations will look back and what they'll take and they'll cherish from what goes on now. It's a fascinating thing. Nostalgists increase as more gamers reach middle age, implies more remakes, etc. So you follow the money, you go where your demographics are. If there are more and more gamers getting to the sort of the reflective and ruminatory middle age that we're sort of seeing, does that mean that the target demographic and audience for remakes of old stuff and rehashes and remasters and whatever you're recalling it these days is going to become more and more lucrative? Is that going to crowd out more and more new stuff?
You just have to look at the console release schedules where it's stuff like, you know, The Last of Us.
I'm sure you've seen this happening.
Yeah, The Last of Us came out on PS3, then came out on PS4. And now there's the PS4 Pro.
Yeah.
And so there's a new version of The Last of Us, which uses the PS4 Pro wars to give you a high res and more. Yeah. And that is going to continue and will continue.
So if we're assuming that computer game manufacture and design is a finite process, only so many games can be made, and a proportion of them that need to tap into nostalgia to sell gets bigger and bigger because the gaming audience is more and more older and more nostalgic.
Every console generation now.
Are we going to see less and less new stuff appearing?
It's going to have a new wave of the last generation's games being remastered, which is going to include the remasters of the remasters of the remasters.
So the stuff that's genuinely innovative and forward-looking and fresh is going to get squeezed out and ultimately disappear.
Out, but there's going to be an awful lot.
Well, there are always new gamers coming in. So.
There's always going to be a market full of an increasing number of good games. Everyone's currently clamoring for a Mass Effect remake.
But that's more nostalgia. Everyone remembers their first go through Mass Effect 1.
And so, you know, that's another three games added to the list of next console generation, all that stuff that can be released, yeah, everyone's happy with.
I've written poisonous question mark, damaging for innovation, the new. Are they mutually exclusive? Yeah, so it's essentially what we were saying there. Does this nostalgia come at the cost of, I suppose, we would call innovation, anticipation? Is that the opposite of nostalgia?
I think there's two things. One is it does mean we're always looking backwards, so we're not maybe looking
is
forward
that
as we could. But I think it is actually healthy in a way, because it means we remember older things that we might otherwise forget.
So we have the opportunity to learn from the past and not repeat our mistakes.
We'll remember that, you know, actually, that is okay in a game. It doesn't all have to be free-to-play clicking. It can be, say, a long-form adventure.
Mm-hmm. I've written symptomatic of aging conservatism there. And I've written Douglas Adams quote underneath, and I forgot to actually write the Douglas Adams quote down. But it's the one where anything that is around when you're born is normal in the natural order of things. Anything that's invented in the first third of your life is new and interesting, and you can probably get a job in it. And anything that happens in the last third of your life is never catch on, is old, and is terrible. That sort of thing is basically that these things don't change. These things are just things, and it's us, our viewpoint as we age, as we change around them, that changes our perception of them. I've written, our shared experiences define us, comradeship and war stories. I mean, that's a very powerful thing. That's a positive, I think, of nostalgia. The idea that we can all form broadly similar past experiences that we can then compare and share and you know, smile at and share a beer about, you know. I think that's one of the positive sides of nostalgia gone right. The games are only a part of it. And I've written there, yeah, so the comrades, the guild, the raid, the static group, the LAN party, pub chat about single player stuff. The context is important as well. What else was going on in your life at the time you had these memories, these things stuck in your brain? Perhaps you were having a difficult home life at the time, or perhaps you'd just met your the love of your life. And, you know, these other aspects of your... Because essentially we are just, you know, heads full of chemicals that transcode different bits of data into different chemical strings. So the mess and mush of chemicals going on in the head at the time.
You.
I know. I'm such a... Life is artistry, yeah. I've written us... It's the people we were, and I've underlined were there. We change. We would. This is what I've been finding in my scientific experiments with these case studies, is going back and looking at these stuff now is perhaps a hiding to nothing, perhaps a bad thing, because we're not the same people, so we can't recreate that composite experience, which is partly context, partly comrades and stuff, partly the objective game itself, but partly how we perceive it. And if how we perceive it is not recapturable, if we can't reverse our own age, we can't go back in time mentally to become the people we were back then.
Speak for yourself.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure about your species physiology. It might be different. So summing up, I've written, can't go back there. I've written two statements here, right? Listen to these. EverQuest was better than Black Desert Online, and EverQuest is better than Black Desert Online.
You see the
two mutually exclusive statements there, and it's the was and the is. That's the thing. Our memories of I'm just picking on EverQuest, picking on Black Desert Online, but game X from 20 years ago was better than game Y today. But if you try and go back to game X today, probably not. Different circumstances, yeah. Different things. I've written EverQuest changed, but we changed more. We can't go back to that time, and we can't go back to who we were. So that's all rather bleak. But I've written at the bottom there, we can go forward.
Yeah.
So my advice, basically, then, is don't try. Whatever you do, don't go to good old games. Don't buy that 20-year-old game that you really loved and have another go, because you're going to ruin it for yourself. I am not going to play Planescape Torment ever again.
Okay.
And I'm going to be happy with that. I'm going to cherish my first couple of playthroughs where I discovered all those extra things I didn't even think was possible. And I'm going to move forward. I've written seize the now, carpe diem, all that. I've written remember the good times, and I've written under there anything might be a gem of the future. So it's about positive outlook. It's about I'm being attacked. Some kind of flying bug thing. Just when I'm doing the important summing up thing as well. Yeah. But basically, you've no idea. Going through just, you know, you're gaming next week. You're gaming with your friends this week. You know, you have a static group. You're playing, or you're just downloading something off of Steam. You've just bought a new game. Play that game. Just be mindful. Be wary. Pay that little extra special bit of attention, because you never know when that memory is going to form.
That first time you downloaded Minecraft, did you know that that was going to be a special game?
Yes. Did you know how many millions of hours you were then going to spend in there? How much mods and what insane constructions you were going to build? And those memories seem mundane at the time, and there's no forewarning, no premonition that's going to be the important thing. In 20 years' time, when you're sat in your hover pub with your Jetsons car parked outside, you're going to be sat there with your virtual FaceTime avatar presence of a friend halfway around the world, and you're going to be chatting about Minecraft, you're going to be chatting about Pokemon Go, but you won't know until it forms which ones are going to be those special gems. So the trick, I think, is just to be
play lots of stuff,
get the scatter approach, be receptive and be open, and just try and just think, is this an antique of the future? Is this a classic of a future gone age? And I think it's the best thing we can do moving forward is to form new nostalgia, because we're basically making investments in our future there. Yeah, there you go. Yeah. See, that was almost an uplifting moral ending there. You'd probably better wrap up then before something down and ruin it.
I'm just going to say, go play retro games. They're fantastic. Okay, yeah, you can go along to howtobettertime.com where you can pick up all our previous episodes where we talk about games which are now retro games which weren't when we started.
Do you remember our first episode?
No, don't listen to the first episode. Listen to the second episode.
Took us a while to find our feet.
You can also go onto YouTube where you can like this and subscribe and all that jazz. You can go onto iTunes where you can leave us comments and stuff. And next week we'll be back with more what we're playing.
What we're playing games, yes. Yeah. Hell, I better play some antiques of the future.
Yeah, I might have to play some actual antiques because Bioshock's out this week.
I need to start playing Kerbal at some point. Too many people are getting on my case about it. And I'm going to really remember my first go at Kerbal because it's obviously going to be a do you remember?
It will be, yes.
It will be, yeah.
And I may have to actually make the videos on the retro gaming that I've been meaning to do for a while.
Ooh.
Yeah.
So with that, we'll see you next time.
Goodbye.